Lately, I've been using a new product that I really like. It's called Superbeads. It's based on Nobel Prize winning research and the nitric oxide principle. Nitrates are converted to nitric oxide in the body, which is the secret to Superbeads activity. Call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeads.com. That's 800-738-2198, intelligentbeads.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. We're answering your questions as part of our weekly Q&A with Layla. And just a reminder that Layla Mudin is also a practitioner in her own right. And if you want to sign up to see her directly without my intercession at the Hoffman Center, she takes appointments. And it's an economical way to get the kind of consultation that you would normally get at the Hoffman Center, the comprehensive consultation that includes a doctor's visit, and also an opportunity for those of you who cannot come to New York to obtain a phone consultation, because phone consultations with Layla are permitted. I, as a medical doctor, require that I lay hands on you, see you for, at the very least, your first visit. While undertaking your medical care. So call the Hoffman Center, check out drhoffman.com for information. All right, Layla, you had a question carried over from last...
Yes, we've got this question from Vladimir. Hi, I have patients, a husband and wife, with a long history of unsuccessful weight loss. They're both borderline type 2 diabetes, with a hemoglobin A1C of about 5.5, but very high body mass indexes. They're both obviously overweight. I recently saw them for a follow-up 3 to 4 months later, and they both lost 20 to 30 pounds by going on the fast metabolism diet by Haley Pomeroy. Obviously, it's difficult to draw a conclusion based on the success of one couple. Please comment. And Dr. Vladimir Berkovich is a doctor.
Right.
He's sending in this question.
Yeah, yeah. He's actually a shout-out to Vlad, because he's one of our good colleagues in the state of New Jersey, and he does a great job. Very, very innovative physician, always very scholarly in terms of and open-minded about looking at new innovative paradigms. So he's saying, hey, what's our take on that? So
yeah.
you did a little research on that?
Yes, yes. Diet? I actually have Haley Pomeroy's books. I actually like her books very much. I like the way she's put this together. This is actually a reverse of the 5-2 diet. And just a little background, the 5-2 diet means 5 days of eating, you know, moderately normally, with 2 days going very low carb.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's actually done the reverse, where for 2 days you're eating pretty much, you know, relatively standard, but then the following 5 or so days that you're, what you're doing is going low carb. And that low carb is a combination with low fat to begin with and then a high fat. And what Haley is doing actually quite successfully is keeping your metabolism guessing.
So
which
like
is the macronutrient
metabolic
that I'm
confusion,
supposed to burn.
Like metabolic confusion. It's almost like the theory
yes.
behind CrossFit exercise is
mm-hmm.
Muscle confusion,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you kind of keep things dynamic and
mm-hmm.
change it up. And, you know, for example, people who do the same workout day in and day out, you know, they just don't get sore anymore. I mean, they're not
right.
challenging. You know, they're using the same muscles, the same duration. It's just not
yeah.
challenging anymore.
I kind of put this in the same boat with people who basically follow a low-carb diet Monday through Friday and then blow it on the weekend.
Right.
And then
but
come back to Monday.
Hopefully not really
but
blow it.
But much more structured.
I don't
not
think
really
you
blow it. Not really blow it at all.
You can't really blow it. You can't really
yeah.
blow it.
Because, you can't really blow it.
So another comment I would have is that this N of 2 study on these two very overweight individuals with a BMI that's high and who are pre-diabetic
yeah.
or diabetic, I don't recall which.
Borderline, yeah,
borderline.
Pre-diabetic.
Those are the patients who are the easiest to get to lose weight. And I wish, some weeks I wish we had, a dozen of those patients, because they really will benefit from a structured diet, whatever type of structured diet, but usually, you know, an Atkins-type diet, or we can, you know, modify it, make it a 5-2 or 2-5. Mm-hmm. They will benefit unfortunately, they often will at some point plateau because the body adapts very well to caloric deprivation. It's hard to have a sustained weight loss unless you're very, very dedicated, long time, consistent, and add a component of serious exercise. So, while it's exciting that they lost, all this weight, it's not entirely surprising. This is the typical response to an early phase of restrictive dieting by someone who is pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetes.
Right.
Now, what worries me more is someone who comes in, and unfortunately we see a lot of these types of patients, the patient who needs to lose, 15 or 20 pounds, has dieted frequently, is already on a pretty darn good diet, and then they say, now what do I do? And that's when, we really have to put it in our thinking caps. We have to look at, what are some of the other factors? Could they be borderline hypothyroid? Do they have adrenal stresses, which is keeping the pounds on? Could they benefit from nutritional support that helps to rev their metabolism? Now there are studies that show that it's harder to lose weight when you're vitamin D deficient. There are studies on EGCG for weight loss. There are studies on capsaicin, which is our chili pepper fat burning supplement, but all those only to a modest degree accelerate metabolism, and there's no magic bullet. And unfortunately, the most challenging type of patient is a healthy, exercising person on a good diet who just doesn't have the body type that they want. They don't look like Kate Moss. They want to be Kate Moss, but they more look like the Renaissance paintings in the museum, in the Metropolitan Museum. That's like a different standard of beauty, but they're healthy and they'll be fine. They'll carry those extra pounds well into their 90s because they're not metabolically compromised. Those are the people who are much more challenging to work with.
That's true. But normally, as you say, there's some kind of biochemical abnormality, and once it's corrected, they can pretty much go happily on their way, especially adrenal, especially low thyroid. So those can be fairly easy fixes for most people.
Right. So let's comment briefly on the weight loss thing, because recently I shared with you an op-ed piece from the New York Times by Gary Taubes.
Yes.
And what Gary Taubes, of course,
diet
is our
advice that ignores hunger.
Right. And so share with us what some of his premises are in there. Because I think that's an important message to dieters.
Yeah, that's true. The diet advice that it ignores hunger, really, his title says a lot of it. When people are given a weight loss diet, typically it has to do with calorie control or eating the same amount of calories every day. That might be 1,600 calories. It might be 1,200 calories. It depends on whether you're a man or a woman, what age you are, so forth and so on, if you're on any medications or what your physical activity level is. But what Taubes is talking about here is that the discussion is always about how much to restrict the calories and how long to do it for, but nobody is addressing the issue of hunger. How long will you remain on a calorie-restricted diet that's keeping you hungry all the time? Because this eventually becomes misery. And this is why the recidivism rate is so high on calorie or fat-restricted diets. Fat-restricted diets, a.k.a. low-calorie diets, is really what I'm saying.
And fat and protein also provide that satiety for a lot of people. So while ultra-low-fat diets may be low-calorie, often they are of short-term efficacy and hard to adhere to.
And the other question he raises is, if people on low-carb diets are actually able to eat less, why aren't they hungry? On a low-carb diet, because hunger actually normalizes and the false hunger of craving carbohydrates and sugar is gone, you actually do wind up taking in less calories. Therefore, hunger is no longer an issue. That is the trick of the low-carb diet, and it is the gift. What needs to happen is everybody needs to embrace this and stop. Science needs to stop concentrating only on calories, but the type of calorie, because the type of calorie determines its metabolic fate.
Right.
A carbohydrate calorie will tend to be stored as fat. A fat and protein calorie, a fat or protein calorie, will tend to be burned for energy within the right span of calories.
Right.
So this also, is what he's really, yeah.
Also he cites studies which show that people who lose a dramatic amount of weight through very calorie restricted diets, when they stop dieting, they gain all the weight back and more. They become they just become extremely hungry, and they even overshoot their prior weight to gain additional pounds. And more, these very restrictive diets also tend to make you lose muscle. And when you lose muscle, your body doesn't look as good, number one, and it doesn't metabolize as well. And the fat you gain is now on a an armature which is less muscular. So you actually end up more flabby and weaker.
So exactly what you don't want to lose on a calorie-restricted diet is muscle mass, lean muscle mass, because that is our metabolism. So by embarking on a low-calorie diet, anyone who's done it, and boy, everybody has, it slows down our metabolism altogether. And you know what? Being hungry all the time, I think it causes a kind of a trauma in some people where they don't ever want to be so hungry and so miserable and so moody and so the B word ever again that they're just going to eat what they want after that. It's almost like a form of rebellion.
Yeah.
But I think it's a form of PTSD to some degree. I don't know.
Well, that's the point well taken, and we do see this in people who've suffered deprivation. You know, often survivors of starvation, the generation of Eastern European Jews who were Holocaust survivors, often they become obese and diabetic later in life because it's very hard for them to diet. Diet has really dread connotations for them. And also
mentally,
the metabolism has slowed to a crawl.
Yeah, I mean, the association of having to go hungry to keep their weight where they want it, that association has to trigger a bad memory. The Holocaust, or whatever the event is that was putting them in semi-starvation mode.
Yeah.
Who wants to go there?
Right, so don't inflict a Holocaust on your body, and it's not the way to go. Not the way to go. All right, so let's move on to the next question.
Okay, all right, here's a fairly easy one from Judy. I'm trying to stay away from milk, and I'm wondering if you've ever seen organic almond milk. I've never seen it. Well, I think I've seen it at Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and some of the better, health food restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Is there?
I think you want to be aware.
Is there a particularly good reason to?
Carrageenan.
Yeah. Is there a particularly good reason to? They talk about foods which are the dirty dozen, the foods that are most likely to be contaminated with pesticides because they're heavily sprayed, because they're very vulnerable to either weeds, or they're vulnerable to animal pests, and some crops are not as excessively sprayed. So do we know if almonds are among the crops that are most heavily sprayed?
Actually, no.
Sprayed?
I've got the 15 highest in pesticides. Mm-hmm. I've got all produce here.
Okay.
Grapes, potatoes, berries, celery, peaches, apples.
So the question is, even does it matter? Organic may or may not confer a big advantage when it comes to almonds.
Yeah.
I just don't know the answer. I'm not saying it doesn't.
But almond milk, you want to beware of any ingredients like carrageenan.
Right.
That would be one to avoid. Carrageenan can be potentially a problem in the GI tract, can cause inflammation. We found this out from the Cornucopia website as well. So Judy, in researching or finding your organic almond milk or any type of almond milk, make sure that there's no added carrageenan.
It could also, almond milk, be a bit of a Trojan horse for added sweeteners.
That's
yeah, because, I mean, I don't usually drink almond milk, but some of them, some of these products look so sweet, and they also may contain things that are not properly identified as sugar, that they have, fancy names, but ultimately deliver a lot of carbohydrate calories.
Exactly. Okay, Judy. Thank you for your question. We have another question here. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I would like you to know I'm the biggest fan of your show. I want to know which is better at telling any biochemistries, a blood test or urine test? Which are the best? Wow, that's a podcast.
The answer is it depends.
It depends.
So urine tests, I mean, generally we use blood tests, but urine tests can be valuable for certain things. Sometimes urine tests are used for hormones. I don't use urine tests very much for hormones. Sometimes you may want to get a 24-hour excretion of certain hormones that tells you if your body is overproducing or underproducing certain things. But generally, blood tests or saliva tests, in my opinion, are best for hormones. There are a few, you know, unique urine tests. One test that is toxic metals, yeah. And I guess that's an interesting question because I think blood tests tend to be inferior to urine tests when it comes to toxic metals. You might have what seems to be under the threshold of mercury or lead, but when you do what's called a provocative chelation and push lead, mercury, cadmium out of your system, that will appear in the urine. It'll be, you know, mobilized from your tissue, and then you can collect it over a period of time, and that gives you a better idea of what's hiding in your tissue rather than merely circulating at that moment in your bloodstream. There's an interesting test that's done with urine that's called a Crosslinks test or an NTX test, and that's a test that actually tells you if you're losing bone at a rapid rate or not. That's a very interesting test, and that can't be done in the blood. There's a test called urinary microglobulin, which is kind of interesting because it tells you if there's a stress or strain on your kidneys. And that test will be more sensitive than looking at, say, your BUN or your creatinine, which also tell you if your kidneys are in good shape. So, you know, urine tests have some value. You know, sometimes we ask for amino acid levels. There's some controversy as to whether blood levels are better or whether urine levels are better. And, you know, so it ain't rocket science. I think we have to be selective. I devote in terms of the time I spend studying stuff, I spend a lot of time studying vitamins and minerals and supplements. I spend a lot of time studying conventional medical diseases because there's always developments. And some of that time I have to spend learning about drugs because patients will come in on new drugs. And, you know, I got my medical degree 30 years ago, so I need to keep up on, you know, what are some of the drugs. Many of the drugs that are around now weren't around when I learned about them in medical school. I spend a fair amount of time learning about tests because tests are really important in the field of integrative medicine. We use tests sometimes that are more, shall we say, innovative, more predictive, more instructive, more like a report card for patients. We really want to give patients lots of feedback. You know, how am I doing? You know, am I at risk? Am I making progress? And so report card kinds of tests that are fine-tuned for nutrition and for detecting early pre-disease states are things we like to do. So,
yes.
You know, so this is, you know, a developing area. We're learning more and more about, you know, the relevance of certain tests. We'd love to do urinary organic acids. That's a fascinating set of tests because urinary organic acids, you know, you use that test, right? You're able to use that test because you're able to do urine tests. That's actually an interesting question because you aren't technically, as a nutritionist, able to order blood tests. You might prompt that and suggest that a patient you're seeing, if they're not seeing me, that they go outside to their doctor and get your vitamin D checked or get your B12
Let's
checked.
Let's see what your ferritin level is. Let's see what your hemoglobin A1C is if I don't have those.
But you're actually
on that
permitted.
Particular patient.
You're actually permitted to do some valuable urine tests. So one of the urine tests that you're able to do is you're able to do a leaky gut test, which is you swallow something and then you basically pee in a bottle and send it off to the lab, and that will tell you whether you have leaky gut syndrome. I think you're also able to do organic acids that are based on urine, right? And that test will tell us about intestinal toxicity. It'll tell us if you have some problems with energy metabolism. It does speak to functional nutrient needs to some extent. So that is a valuable test that
And other tests MDs I can order are the saliva test, which would be the adrenal function test, the pathway fit, the genetic testing.
That which is done with a spit test,
Mm-hmm. It's all spit tests, so those are things I can order.
Okay.
And the rest I send back to their own doctor.
Right.
I send the patient back with a request for their doctor.
So the answer is, there's no set answer as to whether urine tests are better than blood tests. It depends.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Hope that helps. All right.
Yeah.
Just about out of time, unless we have a time for one quick question. Is such a thing as a quick question?
Is there such a thing as a quick question? I don't see any quick questions here.
Okay.
I don't, honestly.
Okay.
I think the one about the almond milk was the quickest.
Okay, great. So, all right, great. So that pretty much sums it up for this week's edition of Q&A with Layla. And a reminder, soon to appear at drhoffman.com. You can subscribe to the podcast. Layla's individual intelligent medicine podcast, to be named.
And you know what, Dr. Hoffman? I think I like your recommendation best. I'll just call it Layla Weighs In.
All right.
Yeah, it's also the newsletter. It'll be connected to a degree to the newsletter. So I like it. Thank you.
All right. It's official. Coming this week, the first inaugural debut edition. You know, it's like it's like you and Colbert, you know, starting the same week.
Oh, you
it's
know, I
week.
Really, really tried to stay up for that. I really tried to stay up for that inaugural broadcast because I think Stephen Colbert is great, but I didn't. You know, 10 o'clock, I'm pretty much out. Oh,
well,
boy.
Here's the good news, folks. You don't have to stay up for Layla's... Layla Weighs In, because it'll be available anytime you like at drhoffman.com starting this Friday. Thanks very much, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.